Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
Welcome to Seasoned. I'm Marisol Castro.
And I'm Chef Plum. Later in the hour, we'll talk to Bryant Terry, author of 5 cookbooks, including the acclaimed Afro-Vegan, and his latest, Vegetable Kingdom.
But first, farms. Did you know Connecticut has over 100 farmers markets? That's fresh food from a lot of local farms. I wanted to know how farming in this very moment might be different from previous seasons. So I spent some time with farmer Pete Nowajowski of Fairgate Farm in Stamford. It's a 1-acre urban farm with a mission to build community through food and education. Now, Fairgate is wedged between the fire station and Stamford Hospital. You might actually hear sirens whizzing by while visiting the farm, and people tell farmer Pete all the time that they had a view of the farm from their hospital beds. I learned a lot while touring the farm, but first, we talked about the volunteer-powered farm's beginnings as a community green space 10 years ago.
It kind of sprung up as a part of a whole renovation, or renaissance even, in the west side of Stamford to kind of bring good health and housing to people.
What was this space before it became Fairgate Farm?
Sure, so there were 3 houses, kind of derelict housing, that were really run down, and they needed to come down. So Charter Oak Communities, which is formerly the Stamford Housing Authority, worked with Stamford Hospital to do a land swap and took over the property, took down the houses, and then the garden sprung up out of that.
You're celebrating your 10-year anniversary. First of all, congratulations.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
How have you seen this space evolve in those 10 years? Because presumably you've survived a couple of presidents and now a pandemic.
Yes, this has definitely been the most interesting year. But yeah, just thinking back 5 years ago or so, very basic. You know, we had some garden beds, some rows growing in the ground. But the past few years, things have changed a lot. We just instituted a farmer's market. This is our 3rd year running that, which is very exciting. Just another avenue to get food to the people. This pergola that we're sitting under right now was based upon a fundraiser that we did. The community all kind of came together. And this is our beautiful outdoor classroom. We have community events here. We've had live music, all sorts of things. So structurally, the farm has changed a lot. We're even going to be putting up a new second greenhouse this fall, so we could kind of do year-round growing and continue education throughout the winter. So it's just kind of building, becoming more established, and it's grown a lot in the past 10 years.
It's grown a lot, and I can attest this pergola is absolutely beautiful. It's probably 94 degrees right now, but it feels a lot cooler because we're in the shade. So thank you for that.
No, my pleasure. Yeah, the grapes do all the work. They love the sun and gives us a little break.
I wonder if you could tell me how you adjusted or how you managed during the pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, this past March, which normally is, we already had the greenhouse full of plants. You know, it's a very busy time of the year for the farm, and kind of being hit with that, we weren't sure. We had big plans for our 10th anniversary season and big community, you know, events with hundreds of people, and we knew pretty much right away that wasn't going to happen no. This summer. So we kind of switched a little bit. We temporarily had to suspend volunteer hours just while we figured things out, and then we came back in May strong after things kind of got under control a bit more in Connecticut. The volunteers came back strong, which had been amazing, and we've kind of shifted to a virtual farm in some sense this spring with online classes, which normally we'd hold here. So with anything from composting to starting your own garden, we did a little campaign where we gave away a lot of our extra seedlings to people to start their own victory gardens. We called them a healing victory garden. So people, yeah, kind of do your own garden at your house too, and that kind of help with the healing. So yeah, a lot of that, and then just the food aspect of it. We've been trying to give away as much food as possible, more so than ever. We actually partner the Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare. They have a foundation that was hugely supportive during the crisis to provide funding and support. So we were able to donate tons of food, literally tons of food over the March, April, May, that time. So that's kind of been the big thing, just being a good support for both physically for food and a little mentally as well.
Yeah, no, I bet. I bet it's, I love it. And I know a lot of people in your industry, I mean, we've all, even in my industry, we've all had to adjust and do things differently. How well versed are you in Zoom and all the online farming?
So Zoom was kind of new to me, but learned that quick and was able to do it. And it worked out really well with the presentations and things. Yeah. But yeah, it's a little different than being out here and, you know, being more hands-on.
Right, right. So I want to go back a little bit to what this originally was. You mentioned that there were some derelict houses here, and now it is this sprawling urban community garden. What is the sense of how the Stamford community coexists with Farragut Farm? Because it is still gentrified. You know, there are still pockets of Stamford that are very white, very upwardly mobile. And this kind of is like this cleavage in between folks that are upwardly mobile and folks that are still trying to figure that out. And so this, to me, this feels very metaphoric, the very nature of this farm. And I wonder how you square that and what you make of it and what your observations are.
You know, the neighborhood has changed a lot. Our big thing here is that we want to build that community. And, you know, we're very welcoming to anybody that wants to come in. So we have people who've come down from North Stamford to purchase at the market. We have people next door and right across the street that come in and volunteer. One of our main volunteers for the past 10 years who has been here from the very beginning, you know, she's here every week still, and she lives right there. So it's a combination. As the neighborhood has evolved, different people have embraced the farm. I think a lot of people take pride in that. You know, this is kind of their farm.
Yeah.
So that's changed a lot. And we try to suit what we do here to kind of tailor to everybody and growing different ethnic varieties, different vegetables and things. Yeah. So people get behind that.
Yeah. No, I would agree. For what it's worth, I'd come here before I went to Fairway.
Yes. And our prices are a lot better, too.
1,000%. What are some of your hopes and dreams for this? You know, a lot of folks that we talk to, you know, it's like, gosh, if you can survive COVID, you can kind of survive anything. What do the next 10 years look like? Or can you even look past the next 10 hours?
Yeah. With farming, you know, there's always more in one day than you can do. We're a little less than an acre here, so there's only so much food that we can actually grow and provide, but we can do much more in the sense of education and community growing and building that aspect of the farm, which is very important as well. And who knows, maybe down the road we will take over some more land around Stamford, and that could be a big vision of just having all these local community farms all around the city and providing a lot more food for the city than having to ship it all from all over the world.
Right. So how many days a week do you have your farmers market?
2 days a week now. It's Thursday afternoons and Saturday mornings. But we're open 5-6 days a week for volunteers to come in.
And what kind of folks are you seeing coming here to your farmers market?
A little bit of everything. We've had toddlers come in, anywhere up to women in their 70s who come, and they've been some of the best volunteers, very dedicated women. And everything in between, you know, we've had student groups come from schools and the Boys and Girls Club. We partner with a lot of organizations like that that come in, and it really gives the kids a chance, especially to kind of learn and see where their food comes from.
What do you miss most about life here on the farm before the pandemic?
The openness and the people. We always had the gate open for anybody to wander in, take a walk through the farm, talk to them, show them, you know, give them a little sample of a fruit growing or something. It's definitely being restored now. People are coming out again, and just someone the other day had mentioned how it was so nice for them to come here to this beautiful green space. They've been locked inside, and now they feel safe here and able to be outside. So that we could kind of get back to that has been very nice.
Let's go for a walk here. So the first thing I see here, these are flowers, yes?
Yes. So we like to line the farm, these raised beds, with lots of flowers and herbs and things. We're part of the Stamford Pollinator Pathway, which means that we pledge we don't use any harmful pesticides, anything like that, and we grow lots of bee and pollinator-friendly flowers. So that's their food.
I love that. And so the pollinating is a crucial part of this farming. Not to be confused with this wood chip pile. What's going on over here? Oh, this is your compost.
This is our compost area here. We have the stalls right next to our greenhouse here, and it's actually a static aerated compost system, which means there is PVC piping underneath the piles with hooked up to a big blower, kind of like you would blow up a bouncy house with.
Yeah, yeah.
But we have it set off hourly, and that blows oxygen into the pile. So instead of having to turn it very often, that oxygenates the pile and keeps the compost healthy and active.
Bouncy houses and nourishment. Yep. I love it.
Absolutely. Very versatile. You never know. That's the farmer ingenuity. People come up with this stuff.
Okay. The first thing I'm seeing here that is edible are grapes.
Yep, we have a new, actually just planted this past spring, our grapevines here. Maybe we'll get into some Farragut Farm wine down the road.
Oh my gosh, totally.
But yeah, we also do Concord grapes, so those are, you know, great for juices and jellies and things. Lots of different variety.
Okay, we've got Stamford Hospital to our right. And yeah. Is that a watermelon?
Yeah, we have watermelon. There's a couple different types of watermelon.
Oh gosh, I'm not stepping on
you're fine.
Living creatures. Okay.
We're good. It's kind of hard to tell right now. These things get a little out of control here. But yeah, a couple watermelons. We have some different types of cantaloupe and muskmelons.
Holy smokes. I'm fascinated by all this. I'll follow you so I don't step on anything that's hoping to make a life.
This here is pretty much our main production area. Mm-hmm. As you can see by all the rows here, this front section has been all from the springtime. We had all our kale and collard greens, Swiss chard.
Tomatillos,
yep. A lot of people love these.
I do. You make one too, right? A salsa?
Yeah, I just made it yesterday for dinner. It was delicious.
Who decides what is going to be planted here?
I do the final plan for what's going to be grown, but that's based off of what has worked in past years, what people like to see. You know, we always have a little survey at the end of each season and people can submit what they like to see grow. And a lot has just been, just what people have dropped off seeds in the past of, you know, special varieties that they have from, you know, taken from their country or that. So yeah, we try to do a collaborative thing, but we grow pretty much everything. So there's a little bit of everything for somebody,
And the soil is presumably fertile enough to grow all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. The soil we've been building, back from when the houses were here, there was a lot of cleanup. So we had to take out tires and lots of rubbish and things. And we actually brought in a lot of tons and tons of organic soil from Eastern Connecticut to kind of start with a fresh, clean layer so that it's safe. And then we've just built it up over the years with lots of compost. So it's healthy. There's tons of worms and living bacteria and things in the soil. Exactly what you want for healthy growth.
It's exactly what I don't want for my children. They seem to come home with dirt and bacteria, but those are growing boys. Are those red peppers?
Chili peppers or hot peppers. 10 different varieties right in this row here. And we have another 10 varieties of sweet peppers. Tomatoes right next to that. Lots of tomatoes. That's probably the most popular crop right now. Eat the rainbow, we say.
Right,
so
right.
Eat the rainbow just with the tomatoes, between the red and yellow, orange,
all sorts of colors.
That
zucchini?
That is zucchini. It's on its last leg, but...
We're approaching the last row of the middle section.
Yep,
what is happening here?
This section ends with okra, which some people love.
Gosh.
Some people are unfamiliar with what happens, but people love coming for that because they always say the stuff in the stores is usually
gross.
Brown and
yeah.
Yeah, and gross. But this is freshly picked and you can't beat it.
Is this a flower, an okra flower? I grew up in the city. What is going on?
Yes, that is the okra flower. Looks like a hibiscus flower.
Yes, that's what I was going to say.
Absolutely beautiful. And those, I think they're only open for one day to get pollinated. And then after that, they'll start growing the seed pod, which is what you eat with the okra.
So the okra flower knew that Connecticut Public was coming today and said, here we are.
Yeah. Yeah. These you have to check every day because if you miss one day, they get too big already. So
really?
Yeah. And then if you notice around the farm, all these trees we kind of been ducking around, these are all fruit trees. So we have cherry trees, peaches, plums, apple trees, all those all around the farm. You know, the bees love them, and so do we when we get to get them before the birds do.
Right. Well, that's what I was just going to ask. How do you, what kind of relationship do you have with the birds, with fruit?
The birds actually haven't been bad. We do have a pack of feral cats that kind of live in the neighborhood here, and they're kind of control the farm at night. Birds, squirrels, anything like that, we really don't have problems with. And in the back there, you see that white box.
I was just going to say, do you have bees?
We do. Yep, those are honeybees right there. This is a new hive that we just added this year, and they're doing great. Those top boxes actually are all pretty much full of honey right now,
no
so
way.
We'll be able to get a good harvest this year, I think.
That was farmer Pete Novojoski from Farragut Farm in Stamford. If you're in the area, stop by the farm. Wish the staff and everyone in the community over there a happy 10th anniversary.
Coming up, satellite farmer Farah Masani, and later, a conversation with activist, chef, hip-hop historian, and cookbook author Bryant Terry. I'm Chef Plum.
And I'm Marisol Castro. This is Seasoned. We'll be right back after the break. I'm Marisol Castro.
And I'm Chef Plum. Next, I want to introduce you to Farah Masani. Farah does some very interesting work in Fairfield County. She's a satellite farmer and a culinary purchaser for a restaurant group. Here, Farah describes her work.
So, I call myself a sorceress, as in I source things.
Wait, can you say that again? Because that's fantastic. You're a sorceress?
A sorceress. A sorcerer of things is a sorceress.
That's right.
But first, I am a woman. I'm a woman of Indian origin, and then I'm a farmer. So I'm an Indian woman farmer who lives and farms in Fairfield County, and I work with Barcelona Wine Bar, sourcing for 18 of the best chefs I have come across over the past decade. So that's what I do.
Satellite farming, which is something I thought was really interesting that you do. Talk about that for a second and how it benefits farmers and restaurants and the communities. It's such an interesting concept.
Yeah, sure. So I didn't wake up one morning and say, oh my God, I'm going to satellite farm and this is how I'm going to do it. It just happened organically. Over the years in my life in Connecticut, I've worked for families that have owned farms. I started my own farm and had my own land, which was rented. And unfortunately, because of the way the house condition was, I had to vacate that property and disband my farm as we knew it. But I wanted to continue to farm, but I was too poor to own or rent land in Fairfield County. So what does one do? One goes out and seeks the land. There's a lot of people that are out here that have beautiful properties, surplus land, that don't want lawns. They just don't want their property to be another lawn that they have to mow and take care of or hire somebody to do that. So I made arrangements with people all across Fairfield County and said, you know what? I will turn your lawn into a growing farm, into growing garden, growing land. We'll grow whatever you want. I'll take care of it. In return, you'll get food for, you know, 10, 20, 15 weeks. The surplus we can donate, we can preserve, we can sell, you can get some money back because you've put in some investment for some fencing maybe, that kind of stuff. And so we're able to grow these really amazing things in people's backyards, teach them, because the ultimate goal is to teach, to get other people to see how easy it is to grow food and how easy it is to access food. That's fresh, that's nutritious, that's not full of pesticides, that's not traveled 5,000 miles from your own backyard. And then take this and spread it around the community. I've done anywhere from 1 acre to 7 acres in the peak of satellite farming. But it's definitely a community environment.
Farah grew up in India, where seeing women farming was just a part of normal life. But that doesn't mean her family embraced the idea of Farah becoming a full-time farmer.
It was very normal to be around women working the fields and women that were cooking. So it wasn't new or different. It was just a thing women did. And then I came to America, got my education. And when I decided conscientiously that I am going to become a full-time farmer because I'm so disgusted with the food in this country, and because there's a direct correlation between people's mental health, physical health, and the kind of food that they eat, that I'm just going to become a full-time farmer, the first thing that my father said to me is like, you left our home country to come to the U.S. to become a farmer after getting all of this education. Right. And I'm like, you know what, Dad? Yeah, I'm going to be a woman farmer here. Because in this country, there's not a lot of women farmers. There's not a lot of farmers of color. So let me start doing that. And it's okay if I don't make money. At least I'll be able to feed myself. And I'll be able to represent a population, women, in an industry that is devoid of it, that doesn't have any. And he's like, you're crazy. And I'm like, okay. Now I look around me and all of my farmers around me, most of them, at least in Connecticut for now, are women. And in the Hudson Valley too, they're women. And it is something to celebrate. It is something to celebrate.
Farah's had a front row seat to the struggles chefs, farmers, and everyday people have had during the pandemic. There are serious food distribution issues, and local food is not always affordable.
we know our system is broken. The pandemic has just shown us over and over again how broken our system is. If I'm watching a dairy farm dispose of thousands, hundreds and thousands of gallons of milk, but I cannot navigate my supply chain to bring that milk to a production facility that will use it, because booking an LTL truck needs to happen in so much amount of time and it needs to be, like, that's not okay. Why are we not nimble enough to move things around without having so many constraints? So farmers are bleeding, nobody's making money, chefs are wanting to have access to it, our infrastructure is not set up for it. So we have to navigate our infrastructure to eliminate these obstacles. That's going to be a hard, long process. And it drives home the point that we need to buy directly from the source. We need to buy directly from the producer, the maker, the grower, the fisher person, whoever, and implement our own supply chain. So you have a limited budget, go to the grocery store, buy the things that you have to buy from the grocery store. That's okay. But maybe you say $20 a week, I'm going to go and use it at the farmer's market. And maybe you'll go there and you'll buy bread, because people love buying bread at a farmer's market. And then, but
you're right about that. Why is that? You're absolutely
people just
right.
Love bread. People love bread. You know, it makes you feel good. It's tasty. Farmers market breads are usually from grains within the tri-state area. They're just so good. And yes, it'll cost $7. And you'll be like, holy, what? $7 bread? But then you'll go home and you'll taste it. And maybe you would have bought that tomato, that $1 tomato. So that's what I tell people. Take a portion of your income, a very small portion of your grocery income budget, and try to use it at the farmer's market.
So that begs the question, can we get some local farm shout outs?
I love sending people to Ambler Farm right in my backyard. You'll be so amazed and impressed as to how much comes out of those fields. Another place that's doing really, really amazing educational work is Wakeman Town Farm in Westport. They're truly, truly doing some amazing educational work with summer camps, growing. They have a small piece of land, but the amount of stuff that comes out of there is impressive. Check out their farm stands. Another farm that I really like to talk about is Speckled Rooster Farm. It's Matt and Jess, these 20-something-year-old kids that went to UConn for ag and started a farm, finally, in East End. And the work that they're doing there is truly impressive. They're not an open farm. It's not like Ambler or Wakeman where you can just walk up. But check them out. They're really, really impressive people. Another place that's very, very dear to me is the Hickories in Richfield.
Oh, what a great spot.
Beautiful spot. Dina Brewster, another woman farmer, right? And also hires so many women. It's an impressive farm that focuses on doing the right thing for farming. And then you have all of your little tiny backyard farmers that are doing great work. So there's Horseshoe Farm also in Richfield that's producing great, great product. And then lastly, I want to have a shout out to our Connecticut fruit farmers, the orchards, because people forget about fruit.
Farah Masani, you have been a pleasure. You have inspired me. I'm going to go cook right now, as a matter of fact. I'm
going to
leave the program, and I'm going to go cook right now. I'm going to go find some great fruits. I'm going to find some great farm products and make an amazing dinner. I look forward to the time where we can spend over a fire making some food together. Hopefully, we can do that really soon.
Indeed. Fire cooking is my way to cook.
Thank you, Farah. Farah Masani is a sorceress and a satellite farmer in Fairfield County.
After the break, activist and author Bryant Terry discusses how hip-hop influenced his diet and how he came around to the idea of growing his own food.
The lessons that I learned in the garden, I'm not going to romanticize it. I hated it back then. my granddad was exploiting my labor.
Stay with us. This is Seasoned.
This is Seasoned. I'm Marisol Castro.
And I'm Chef Plum.
Plum and I were lucky enough to have a conversation with food justice activist and cookbook author Bryant Terry. Bryant is the author of 5 cookbooks, including the acclaimed Afro-Vegan. Vegetable Kingdom is his latest cookbook and the one making us very hungry right now. Aside from being a James Beard Award-winning chef, Bryant, well, he has just about the coolest job you can possibly have in the food world. He is the chef in residence at the Museum of the African Diaspora, or MOAD, in San Francisco.
We'll get to that a little later, but first, we asked Bryant about his early food influences, which you might be surprised included hip-hop.
Yeah, so Boogie Down Productions, one of the greatest hip-hop crews ever.
Big up to the Bronx, I'm doing my X.
Big up to the BX, yes. So, I grew up eating what most people would argue is a pretty whole foods, vegetable-centered diet. And it's because my grandparents came from the rural South. And so they brought those agrarian traditions and knowledge into the city. So even though we grew up in Memphis, the city, they had community gardens, urban farms, all in their neighborhood. And so the food that I was eating is the type of food that I promote, you know, local, seasonal. I mean, sometimes we literally would harvest it right before eating it. But then, you know, I get to high school, I'm an athlete, and I go off on the deep end with the fast food stuff because that's what my buddies were doing. I feel like that period was important for me. Because as an educator, I think, you know, it's important to be able to meet people in a non-judgmental way. And so when I work with young people, I get why they are consuming a lot of fast food and processed foods and packaged foods, because I went there for a second. But then hearing this hip hop song, Beef, that talks about factory farming and the negative impact it has, not only on our health, but animals and the environment, it just really changed everything for me. Because like a lot of people, I was under the assumption that, you know, cows are just kind of running around in the field and they go to sleep and then we eat them. But, you know, learning about how they can be treated in this industrialized food system really made me question a lot of my politics and assumptions and habits around food. And so that's where it all started for me.
Yeah, that song is pretty intense, Marisol. I'm not sure familiar with it, but one of my favorite lines from the song is, he has drugs to make the cow grow quicker. Through the stress, the cow gets sicker.
21 different drugs are pumped into the cow in one big lump. So just before it dies, it cries in the slaughterhouse full of germs and flies. Off with the head. They pack it, drain it, and cart it. And there it is in your local supermarket. Red and bloody, a corpse neatly packed. And you wonder about heart attacks? Come on now, man, let's be for real. You all what you eat is the way I feel. But the Food and Drug Administration will tell you meat is the perfect combination. See, cows live under...
Yeah, so brilliant, so cutting edge. And like you said, it's just like... You know, we were in a moment where during that period, a lot of rappers were getting more political and talking about larger social issues. But I don't think anyone talked about food issues in the way that Kara S1 did. And that just taught me about the power of art and culture and music as well to change people's, you know, habits and attitudes. You know, sometimes a book may do it. Sometimes it may be a lecture, but sometimes it might be a song.
Interesting to hear you, Bryant, talk about, you know, you grew up in the South and there's this KRS-One, who's from the Bronx. I can tell you, as a card-carrying Bronxite, there were not community gardens in the 80s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s. And a lot of us did grow up on TV dinners. I was fortunate. I grew up in a Puerto Rican household. Rice and beans were always on the menu because that was like the perfect protein. And so what part of you and your upbringing and that evolution did you bring with you when you became a father and you became the chef in residence of MOAD? Because, you know, I was telling Plum, I feel like this food justice, talking about, you know, the way we eat food has become more in vogue. Certainly when I was coming up, you ate what you ate and that was it, whether it was cow or vegetable. And there's been a transition. And I wonder if you could address that for us.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I totally understand the way that the Bronx was, neglected. And so much of that, you know, I mean, there are lots of films and documentaries that talk about that period. And the exciting thing to me, when we think about like what's happening, I mean, art, culture, but specifically food, some of the most cutting edge food work is coming out of the Bronx. You know, you have
Ghetto Gastro.
You have the Wonderkin, Kwame Onwuachi, the chef who's based in D.C. Yep. So I feel like they're redeeming the Bronx from a lot of the negative stereotypes that people have from, you know, that period in the 70s and 80s, where it was seen as kind of like just this like war zone. So big up to the Bronx. But, you know, I moved from New Orleans to New York City, and I was actually a doctoral student in history. And, you know, the research that I was doing really led me to this food activism because, you know, initially when I heard beef and decided to change, it was really about my personal practice and my personal decisions. But as a grad student, learning about some of the programs and work that was done in the late 1960s, particularly the Black Panther Party, which a lot of people have these negative perceptions of, but I learned that they had a number of powerful and meaningful community programs that addressed food and health and access to food and health. You know, they had grocery giveaways where they were giving away bags of groceries to low-income people in the Bay Area. And then they started their Free Breakfast for Children program in 1968 that was aimed at feeding children a hot, nourishing breakfast every morning. And, you know, now we have innumerable academic studies that connect academic outcomes with nutrition, behavioral outcomes with nutrition. So I just think the fact that they were ahead of the game back then and really making connecting these dots is so powerful. And that inspired me to do food activism. Because the reality is when I would be on the subway at 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning, I would see kids eating candy bars, bags of chips, drinking sodas and sugary drinks and energy drinks. And it just made me realize that this idea that the scholar Raj Patel talks about being stuffed and starved. You know, they were eating edible food-like substances, but they were devoid of nutrients and they weren't being fed in the way that all children deserve to be fed, like wholesome, nutrient-rich food. And so I decided to found an organization that really addressed this by working with young people, using cooking as a way to really get them excited about the politics of food and to encourage them to change their communities.
Yeah, I think it's important too. You're seeing a kind of a shift a little bit in younger people becoming more interested in food, seeing people like yourself kind of help push them to, doesn't have to necessarily be a vegetarian or vegan diet, but just eating real food and understanding where food comes from.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, I don't think there's one perfect diet for any one of us. And this idea that a vegan diet is somehow a panacea and you're just going to have the healthiest diet and, you know, your skin's going to be glowing, you're going to live to your 150. You know, I think there are arguments to be made about how a plant-centered diet can be healthful, but I think the most important thing, as you mentioned, I want people eating real food. I think we need to shift from the standard American diet, which is full of a lot of processed and packaged foods and very meat-centric, to having a more vegetable-centric diet and just eating whole grains, legumes, nuts, seeds, just real food. If we can shift in that direction, we'll address a lot of the health issues that we've been seeing, you know, rising exponentially over the past several decades.
Right. Preventative is definitely, you know, we're such a reactionary community of humans that consume. Which leads me to, and this is just a quick hard left, how on earth do you become the chef in residence of Moed? Who invented that title? Did you invent it yourself? Because if you did, I want to steal it and become the resident and chef of something. I don't know what.
Yeah, this is something that we created. The former executive director of the museum, she approached me and she really saw this museum, which, you know, I think to put it in context, you know, the museum is in San Francisco and the out-migration of Black people over the past decade or so from San Francisco because of gentrification and a number of issues has taken the population from about 13% to around 3% now.
Wow.
And so that's a significant loss of Black folks who have been in the city for generations. And so this museum holds a special place in a city like that. She was so brilliant in understanding the role that institutions that may not focus on food. You know, this is a fine art museum, but she wanted to use that space as a platform to educate the public and create programs that are addressing issues that affect us all. You know, if we talk about the way that we're consuming food, it impacts the environment, it impacts local economies, and it certainly impacts personal health, which leads to these public health issues. And so, you know, it's just been so exciting for me to be able to be a resource for people and inspire people. And, you know, I knew people from San Francisco and the region would be here, but we've had people literally flying in from New York City just to come to a 2-hour program at the museum. And that's been inspiring to know that, you know, we're filling a void.
Black-owned restaurants and businesses in general are finally getting some attention in the media. But I have to tell you, we were really hard-pressed to find Black-owned farms in the state of Connecticut. We asked Bryant for his take on the lack of Black farms across the country, and he had a personal connection to the issue.
First of all, I think it's important to note that land was systematically taken from African Americans throughout the 20th century. There was a lot of land that had been amassed by Black farmers, and whether it was, you know, violently taken by white supremacists or taken by the USDA. I mean, there's a history of our USDA actually taking farmland from many Black farmers. And so when you think about land, and you know, it's the basis for self-sufficiency, you know, to be able to grow your own food, to have a place where you can raise your family. My family actually experienced our farms being taken in rural Mississippi and Arkansas. So this is an issue that's very close to me. And I think that, you know, in general, we need to be doing more to support small to mid-sized farmers. Unfortunately, our government subsidizes the multinational corporate farms, and they're producing some of the foods that we're fighting against, you know, foods that are converted into the fast foods and the processed foods and packaged foods, these big commodities. And so, you know, I always say that one of the reasons, there are innumerable reasons that we should support local farms. I like to start with, you know, people's self-interest. When you get food that's locally grown, it's just going to be so much more delicious than foods that's been shipped across the country from California in refrigerated trucks for weeks and sitting in, you know, refrigerators. And so just on that, like, go to your farmer's market. Those, I promise you.
Go to Plum's backyard. His garden is flourishing right now.
Well, as Chef's speaking here, I'm trying not to jump out of my seat and start cheering like I'm at church. He is preaching everything that I live by every single day when it comes to cooking food. Chef, honestly, buy local food. I don't worry about organic. Just buy good local food from local farmers, man. You're helping the farm, and you're getting really good product most of the time. And you'd be surprised. Most of these guys will talk to you about the food. They'll help you with it. They want to be a part of your life.
The point you made, I think, is so important in terms of like supporting local growers and not getting so obsessed with this USDA organic certification. Because,
yes,
frankly, it's pretty toothless when you think about the standards that farmers in California set around organics in the 90s. And as compared to the USDA standards, the bar is so low in terms of like what can be allowed to be labeled organic.
And how expensive it is to get certified in that. A lot of these local farms, they can't afford to get certified like this, but they're just growing. Most of their stuff is organic. It's how they've always grown their food.
Yep, exactly. It's cost prohibitive for so many of them. And as you said, when you talk to them, they'll let you know, we're using methods that don't require any chemical pesticides. And so I think it's important to support them, and it puts money in their pockets and it helps everybody else. But in terms of my own upbringing, I like to remind people that the work that I'm doing is standing on the shoulders of so many ancestors that came before me. And the lessons that I learned in the garden, trust me, I'm not going to romanticize it. I hated it back then. my granddad was exploiting my labor. But, you know.
Of course.
That's why we procreate, so that our offspring can help us.
So yeah, you know, harvesting and weeding and shelling peas and shucking corn was not fun as a 9-year. I wanted to be out playing. But one, I got to spend such quality time with my grandfather in the garden. Two, just the life lessons that he taught me through agriculture that I can apply to other parts of my life. Three, really being, you know, intimately involved in the seed to table process and understanding the labor that goes into it. So I think one of the biggest things for me now, you know, from that point on, I just understood that food doesn't magically appear on our plate or magically appear in supermarkets. There's a lot of work that it requires. I have so much respect and do a lot of work just to ensure that we're supporting the people who make sure that we have such a diverse and abundant food supply. And so often these are the folks that are being marginalized, vilified, you know, when we talk about the recent kind of xenophobia that's been permeating our country. Yeah, like, trust me, if we were to magically disappear all these people that are being kind of painted as like the bad foreigners, our food system would collapse. And so we really need to rethink how we're treating the people who are making sure that we can have good food.
We could have talked to Brian all day about the importance of local farms, but we had to move on to recipes. And we got started with grilled corn.
Now you say grilled corn to this neophyte like me. I'm like, all right. It's corn and it has a char on it. I mean, I love elote. Put a little cotija cheese on something and I'm down. You're elevating this. Please enlighten us. Speak to our bellies.
I don't even want to frame it as me elevating it. I guess for me, it's just about reintroducing vegetables to people. A couple weeks ago, I was doing an interview. We were talking about the way in which many kids have an aversion to vegetables. Part of the reason that a lot of kids feel that way, and I understand, it's because their experiences with vegetables so often have been with industrial vegetables. Canned goods, frozen vegetables, eating the kind of like cooked to death vegetables that they might get at school. And so I just want to show people that when you're using, as we were discussing, farm fresh seasonal ingredients, you can't go wrong. You know, there's not a lot that you need to do with it. And this corn, real corn, is an example of that. You know, it's just a simply real corn. And I do have the accoutrement, this charred habanero oil and the creamy cilantro sauce to really like boost the flavor. But honestly, with corn that you just picked up from the market that morning, really all you need is some type of fat, some olive oil, some butter, and some salt and pepper, and you're good to go. And so...
If it's good corn, that's all it needs, that's for sure. Right? Chef, what do you think? I try to tell people a lot too, but I want to hear, you definitely would be more proficient at it than I would be. Some tips when it comes to buying corn. Like, what's the best way, how it feels in your hand, how it smells, like to when you pick it up from the grocery store or from the market?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know. I'm sure people who buy corn at markets or even at the supermarket, conventional supermarkets, you might see the old aunties kind of taking the husk and
yes, I hate doing that. It's too laborious. Do I have to?
You don't have to, but it's a great way just to like peek inside. But I think one of the main tips is you want to ensure that the cob is plump. You know, oftentimes if they look a little shriveled, that's a sign that it's old. You want the kernels to be plump and milky. And then when you peel back the husk a little bit, you just don't want it to be weirdly shriveled and dry.
Got back with corn.
I have corn in my hands that I bought at the farmer's market. Can I peel one back? Can you tell me if I'm on the road to culinary heaven? Oh, this is a disaster. These kernels look like they have just come off the back of a Harley going across country.
Let me tell you though. So don't get rid of that. You can peel those husks off, get you a big pot, put 2 quarts of water in there, and then boil those for, I don't know, half an hour, an hour. And then you're going to have this rich, milky corn broth that you can then use for the base of soups or stews, or you can just drink it, which I like to do sometimes. So,
you know, Chef, I actually take the corn threads that come off when you peel the corn back. I take those and I deep fry them in hot oil and use them as garnish on top of stuff. It tastes like popcorn.
What?
Yeah. Try it, Chef. I think you'll think it's awesome.
I'm on it. Thank you for that tip.
You got it.
Who knew this interview would turn into this? I love it.
That's right. And that cilantro cream sauce. I love this sauce. It's very similar to something I've made. You make it creamy using the cashews, right?
Yep. So cashew cream, as I call it, is one of the staples that I use so that people have a plant-based option for making things creamy. So in cases where you might use heavy cream or you might use like milk, you know, sometimes I use that in smoothies to make it creamier.
Nice.
Or if a recipe like, I don't know, cornbread, for example, might, you know, to give it a little creaminess using there. So yeah, it's just raw cashews that have been soaked and blended in water.
The sauce I was talking about when you started the interview off, that's very similar to yours. I actually throw avocado in it to make it creamy.
Ah, look, I am so there with you. I just recently ran across this avocado-based ice cream brand.
Oh yeah.
And I have to say it's some of the best non-dairy ice cream that I've ever had. So
really?
The avocados.
Listen, vegetarian or not, fat is where it's at. That's what I'm talking about. You want flavor? That's where it's at.
the good fat. What about your chickpea fennel potato situation inspired from your time in Brooklyn?
Big up to Brooklyn. Yeah. You know, I fetishized Brooklyn for much of my childhood because of many of the hip hop artists that I loved and Spike Lee's films and
550 State Street.
Yeah. That first neighborhood, it was a largely Caribbean and Hasidic Jew neighborhood. And so it was just coming from New Orleans, it was like a whole other world just being there and like seeing such an international neighborhood in the middle of New York City. So it's important for me to remind people, because I think so often when people talk about vegetarianism, veganism, many people kind of imagine these as these practices of either like, you know, young, cool hipster, white hipsters living in urban gentrified cities, or before that, the stereotype was like upper middle class white suburbanites. And so I want to remind people that there's a history throughout the 20th century of Black food and health activism, and much of it, you know, really encouraging plant-based eating. And one of the big inspirations for a lot of my practices comes from Rastafarians, one of the main religions in Jamaica and they have cultivated what they call an ITAL diet, which is a diet devoid of any chemicals or, you know, additives, and it's largely vegan. And so there were a lot of health food stores in Brooklyn at the time. You can go get you some, you know, fresh juices, or you can get you just whatever. And so the Caribbean restaurants were a great resource for me as a person who eats a plant-based diet to get some really flavorful, delicious vegan and vegetarian food that also felt culturally relevant. You know, I think because of the macrobiotic movement in the 1970s, so much of the way that we imagine healthy eating is inspired by Japanese and kind of like East Asian cooking. You know, for me, I'm just like, I'm a person of African descent, and to see, you know, other people throughout the Black diaspora eating in this way inspires me and just helps me to connect with people who might see veganism or vegetarianism as something that doesn't have to do with their culture. And it's like, no, this is something that we do as well.
And the food tastes good.
We always got to start there, right? You know, the food can be as environmentally sustainable, as healthful, whatever. But if it's not delicious, I don't want it. And I know the average eater feels that way. And I think you have to start with really good food. And then we can talk about the politics and everything else. So,
what about your barbecue carrots?
Oh, yeah. Now we're talking.
I made barbecue carrots by mistake last week. I'm just going to leave it there.
Well, she sent me a picture of them. They were burnt and charred. And I said, they're barbecued.
How did you cook them? How are you cooking them?
What had happened was, a day earlier, Plum and I had a wine tasting, so I had a fridge full of rosé.
Say no more. I already know where this is headed.
I had the wherewithal to take the chicken thighs off. I forgot about the carrots. And then suddenly I looked up, I was like, oh, we're having barbecue carrots. They were delicious, though. And really, all I had added was salt, pepper, and a little bit of olive oil.
You know, one thing that I've typically avoided throughout my career as a cookbook author is just kind of like replicating what are typical meat dishes and veganizing them. You know, I just always felt that was like kind of corny. It's like, hey, we got like, you know, a steak. Now I'm just going to have a big block of tofu and pour some brown sauce on it. Steak. And I'm like,
or the portobello mushroom gimmick everybody used to do.
Oh,
you know, for the vegetarian.
Yeah, that one, sure. So, you know, I really try to push people to be a little more creative. But I had actually, my wife and I went to a restaurant in San Francisco, and they had carrots. They slathered them in harissa, right? Mm. The Middle Eastern hot sauce. It was so delicious. I was like, I'm going to do this, but I'm going to blackify it. So I'm going to add some barbecue sauce and, you know, pair it with some beans and then this Memphis coleslaw to cool everything down. And I have to say I'm proud of myself. Because here's the thing. The litmus test for the success of my recipes is if my kids like it. I'd say at least 80% of the recipes in Vegetable Kingdom, I ran it by them and I got their approval. And there were a lot of like spitting the food out the mouth, like thumbs down. So,
really?
You know, because I'm experimenting. I'm testing recipes. And so they were very candid about their opinions. And when I saw their reaction to having that one, I was like, yes, nailed it.
That was Bryant Terry. Bryant is hard at work on a new book called Black Food. It's a celebration of recipes, essays, and artwork throughout the Black diaspora.
You can find a link to Vegetable Kingdom, along with Bryant's recipes for grilled sweet corn, his Brooklyn-inspired chickpea dish, and those barbecued carrots on our website, ctpublic.org/season. Join us next week at 3 p.m. for our first ever live show. That's right, folks, I have a live microphone. Blow up our phones with your cooking questions. And my Food Network buddy and judge on Beat Bobby Flay, Michelle Ragusas, is going to be hanging out with us too. And we have no idea what's going to happen.
I'm Marisol Castro.
I'm Chef Plum. Seasoned is produced by Robin Doyon-Aiken and Katie Tolarski.
Thanks for listening.